things are going to change, and you'll need to refine it. What a customer says is not always what they mean. The word that's coming to mind right now for me is advocate.
Welcome to Venture Visionaries, the podcast where we explore the strategies of leaders who are shaping the future of business. I'm your host, Thomas Egemet, and today's guest is Nick McEvely, an independent fractional chief product officer who partners with startups, accelerators, and venture studios to test ideas, find product market fit, and scale efficiently. In this episode, we'll explore Nick's journey from rejection in acting to success in venture capital, his insights on startup pivots, the future of AI and SaaS as he sees it, and his community-focused work in Mexico City. If you're interested in launching and scaling startups, this is the conversation for you. Let's dive in. I'm really curious how you feel some of your childhood experiences or key role models shaped your entrepreneurial mindset.
Two things I think really played into it. And thanks for having me, Thomas. I was a tinkerer. I liked to build stuff out of Legos, and Kinect, all sorts of things. I used to make little fountains as gifts for my family members. I made some skateboards and things as a small business in high school. And so I've always liked to make things. That played into my role as a designer later in my career and what I do now, which we'll talk about more. And then earlier as well in high school or so, I did some acting. I was did some stage acting. I was in a couple of commercials here and there. Let's not talk about it too long. That really primed me for rejection. I went on probably 100 or 200 auditions and only got 4 jobs or something like that. And so I was rejected from most of these things. I think it was tough at first, but after a while, my skin thickened and I realized that it was really about fit. And if I wasn't the right person for them, that was fine. And so later on in my career, when I was raising venture capital and getting money from investors, rejection was abound. I approached it, I think, with the same grace. If it wasn't right, it wasn't right. No big deal. Kind of move on. And I think that's a key criteria for anything that's difficult, but especially when you need to get buy-in from other people, whether they be investors or team members or for anything like that.
A lot of the building you do now is very software, literally. Do you still have an opportunity to work with your hands?
I do, and I've been trying to make more of them. I live here in Mexico City, and I got really involved in mezcal. I don't know, are you familiar, Thomas, with mezcal, the agave spirit? It's similar to tequila, just cooked a little differently and has more varieties of sources. And it's just a storied, incredible spirit. So I started a little hospitality experience focused around mezcal, the story of mezcal. That got me out from behind my computer. That got me into kind of some of these fabricas and haciendas that are growing and making mezcal. And I love that. And I started doing some painting. So yeah, I stay creative. Yeah. I have an Instagram for it. It's called Tu Casa Tasting. And you can check out, feel free to book some experiences there.
How do you describe what you do and the value you seek to add to the entrepreneur ecosystem right now?
I'm a fractional product leader, mainly for early stage technology companies. And the reason why I think that's so great is because that was the function that I served in a company I co-founded almost 8 years ago that became Mode Mobile. And I was at the helm of 4 pivots at that company. And so I was redesigning the software itself, doing UX design, UI design. I was redesigning the marketing site and the marketing campaigns. I was doing the deck for pitch deck for fundraising and for sales and using my full design capacity throughout the whole entire thing. And I realized that that was a really pivotal skill to have for early stage tech companies. Like a designer is super important. After a while, the company began to scale and I decided that I liked that pivoting moment a lot more. And so I decided to stay in that space and started an agency with 2 other partners called Further Faster that was really maniacally focused on the pivot moment and finding product market fit. How do you do that really fast and really cheaply or economically? Because that's the constraints that startups are under. It was my design background that allowed me to realize that finding product market fit or choosing the right idea to invest in is one of the most valuable skills that an entrepreneur can have. Even if you find one thing that's working, the market's going to shift, the customer attitude's going to shift, things are going to change, and you'll need to refine it. It's a muscle I've really dedicated myself to developing. and now share it with other entrepreneurs. I offer consulting and what's called now fractional leadership for startups at their earliest stages.
Is there a particular type of startup or industry that you find yourself focused on?
These days, it's like health tech and AI, and I've been having some fun in those. But what I do really translates between industries and even goes between stages, Series A, Series B, Series C companies can use really great product discovery and customer discovery processes. And it's something that's often overlooked.
I'm wondering if you could kind of walk us through what is in the Pivot toolbox.
What a customer says is not always what they mean. There's a magic or an art there in terms of interpretation. I would say customer interviews are the linchpin. Doing really good customer interviews is really important. I oftentimes split my 1 hour long interview into two parts. The first part, I'll ask what's called a jobs to be done style interview. I'd recommend folks look up that framework. But it's basically where I ask them about a previous experience that's very similar to the one I'm exploring. Instead of a hypothetical where someone would say, I would use that, or that sounds like it could fit into my world, this is exploring a real world example and a decision process that they've gone through in the past. And then the second part, I'll show them a visual of some sort. Sometimes it's a clickable prototype. Sometimes it's a simple mock-up. Sometimes it's a competitor website. And I'll get their thoughts on the product itself. Mm. And with those two things, over the course of 6 to 8 interviews, you don't have to do too many. You know, 6 to 8, less than 10 is fine. You can surface some really clear patterns across those interviews. And those will fuel your sales strategies, your marketing, copy, and your product functionality.
Could you tell us a story of running through one of these engagements with these user interviews and surfacing something uncommon or unexpected?
Unexpected. Yeah. So I was just working on a financial management tool for VCs to manage their portfolio. So venture capitalists have maybe a portfolio of anywhere between 20 and more than 100 companies that they have stakes in. They need to know what's going on with their portfolio company, at least on a monthly basis. Usually don't get updates more than a quarterly. We were building a tool for VCs to make that whole process easier. What we realized is that the incentives on the platform really needed to focus on the startups themselves who were plugging in their accounting software. And they were really sensitive about sharing accounting information and you know, their book so transparently. There's a narrative that sometimes needs to be spun or context that needs to be added to numbers and performance. And so we then built a tool that allowed the founders to kind of add that context and create that narrative. And even then, they were still sensitive about connecting, you know, and automating this process, because you can automate it through a QuickBooks or a Xero or one of the accounting platforms. The whole process like becomes 10x faster. But in that efficiency came a little too much transparency. And so we couldn't get the incentives to align between the founders and the investors. The investors, of course, wanted that automated process, but the founders were too sensitive to do it. And so the company needed to pivot up to private equity, where the control for private equity and the books of their portfolio is much more kind of cohesive. Everybody's using similar accounting systems. You can dictate if they automatically connect their tools. And so that was definitely a moment where, you know, it was unexpected that the transparency wasn't going to be a benefit, because that's what's needed. I think you've covered this in the past on your podcast, that in order for meritocracy to really exist in the VC ecosystem and startup ecosystem, we need to have more transparency, because I think, you know, certain things will cloud VCs and, you know, perception on if a certain founder is the right one to invest in. And if someone's just performing well and they're really transparent and honest and they have integrity, that's where your dollars should be going. It's unfortunate that the tool didn't kind of caught on in the investor ecosystem.
The often, I think, under talked about trade-off between transparency and power, that a lack of transparency, while often a source of inefficiency and pain for people, is also a source of power, because then who gets to gatekeep what the information is where? And coming with a tool like the one you're working with, on one hand, is incredible from a transparency perspective, and I think long-term great for the ecosystem. In the short term, I can totally understand how founders feel exposed, and there's like a loss of power in terms of the ability to tell your story. I love how you tie that to, but like, I'm curious about when the moment from insight to pivot. You do these interviews, you surface this insight. How do you generally go about influencing at that point? When do you shoot off?
That took about 6 to 9 months of iteration, effort to try to make that dynamic work. The tea leaves became clear at a certain point. And so now the company is, I think, looking for acquisition. And so we're shopping around for a PE shop that would normally build something similar in-house to just buy this tech because it's been designed pretty well, if I may say so myself, and is super useful. So I think that those founders learned a lot and are going to hopefully see some liquidity in this trade. The software will go on to see a better day. Of course, AI is changing the SaaS landscape forever. What we knew as B2B SaaS doesn't exist anymore because people are going to be able to build their own tools a lot faster, more custom. And that's usually what I've seen that kill early stage B2B SaaS companies is that they build functionality and features for a specific client, but no other client really needs those things. And so their resources are allocated improperly. And so I think that there is actually a silver lining to the correction that's happening in the SaaS industry and how AI is going to be impacting those things.
What are you most excited about and what are you most afraid of as you kind of look into the future right now and why?
The thing I'm most excited about is the role of design in how AI tools are configured. So I think most of the heavy lifting is being done in kind of compiled modules and libraries, things like what we're calling agents these days. And so you can kind of tap into a bunch of agents really quickly, but how do you coordinate all those agents and customize those agents, tweak them, configure them for your specific needs and chain them all together? And like, what is the interface that looks like that? So I'm designing something for that, like that right now. And I think it's a problem that a lot of AI companies are going to run into because they need to make that technology accessible for end users, right? Mm. Not everybody's a ML engineer or, you know, understand how this stuff works. So that's the thing I'm most excited about is the role of design in the usability of AI. Right now, it's a simple chat interface for most folk. Like that's what we interact with. And that's very two-dimensional. It's very native. It feels good to us, but it's also very plain and simple. And so I think the dimensionality is going to change. It's going to be audio. It's going to be in our ears. Going to be probably a little bit more tactile at some point. Like there's really interesting things that are ahead for AI. And the thing that makes me so nervous, how deep learning works. Like deep learning, which is a subset of machine learning that is basically black box. You don't really know how it's creating the outcomes. It's really hard for a human to kind of understand and connect and trace the pieces that led to an output. And all you can do is kind of tweak it, watch what happens. And I think that that's one of the scariest parts about AI is that there's something happening that we can't quite understand. And at some point, you know, humans are going to have that leap of faith, potentially, is might be the right thing to call it. But that's the thing that makes me nervous, is the stuff that are beyond our minds and are hard for us to understand and interpret.
Do you see anyone or any places taking these concerns seriously that you feel optimistic about? Or what are you doing with that concern right now?
Shit, that's a good question. Not enough. I don't know if anyone's really tackling this. I do know that there is a center for ethics focused on AI. I know that there's a couple of like academics, obviously, that are focused on this. The debacle between Sam Altman and Elon Musk right now around OpenAI's focus and corporate structuring, I think is focused on ethics, public good. So I think that there's litigation that's going on in this area right now. There's academic exploration that's going on in this. I hope that there's something going on in government, but I don't have too much faith in the ability of the people in our government right now to understand this stuff, especially when, you know, things didn't go too well with the cryptocurrency boom a few years ago. So I think tech literacy in government is important. And it seems like we're relying on the academics and the nonprofits to have those voices to at least shed light on the dangers of the lack of ethics.
You're doing things differently, taking on kind of a fractional product leadership role, specifically choosing not to dive in, having your hand playing in lots of different businesses, choosing to live in Mexico City. Have you always been somebody who's kind of walked off the beaten path?
It feels like that sometimes. And I think this is becoming more common with the next generation, future generation, that the beaten path isn't as beaten as it used to be for us. and for previous generations. And so like the idea of doing something that just feels good to you is going to become more popular, I think, and more conventional. So I'm excited for that transition. And maybe I'm just on the forefront of that generational or lifestyle change.
And why Mexico City?
It is an incredible city. It is so vibrant and rich with all sorts of events and institutions, bright people. You can get to a forest in like 30 minutes to an hour, depending on traffic. So you get the balance between nature and city. And one of my favorite things about Mexico in general, the country compared to the United States, is that the rich history that pre-existed colonialism exists today. And in the United States, we don't have that. And I think that that's really upsetting. And we've lost a lot of color and richness in American culture because that's been wiped away. I mean, even immigration, you know, immigrants that come to our country, to the United States, homogenized. Like my grandfather was Italian and my grandmother chose to not teach Italian to my mother because for assimilation purposes. And my grandfather changed his name from Dominic to Nicholas because of bigotry. And so this is back when Italians weren't considered as white as they are now. One of my favorite things about Mexico and the thing that's keeping me here is that I feel, even though they're not my roots, I feel a sense of rooting here that is just contagious and beautiful. And I just want to be around that energy, really appreciate what it does to my daily life. And when I go back to the United States, sometimes it just feels like we haven't really been good stewards with urban planning and architecture and community design, transportation, infrastructure, all sorts of stuff, but we've separated each other. And I feel that very much.
Do you think that living in a place where you experience that deeper sense of rootedness and that has that longer stretch of history around it, and at least from your vantage point, feels more integrated communally, affects how you think about your business or your work or your work-life balance? And if so, how?
I'm actually in the process of helping start a canned water company down here that's focused on water security, because that's a really big issue for Mexico City and the country at large and other countries. It's a really big issue in the United States, right? Like Flint, Michigan is still not water secure. And there's dozens of other communities in the United States that don't have that water security. So I'm using my skills in branding and product development to build a consumer product that has a benefit, a community benefit. We're starting off with 30% of profits go back to water security projects and innovation projects that get more water into the ground and refilling the aquifer faster, are catching water from the clouds, you know, during rainy season, are reducing water consumption in certain utilities and equipment in a home. And so I feel like by living here in Mexico City, I felt inspired to use my skills to help address a problem in my community. I don't know in the US if I have felt that. I mean, I kind of started my career in urban agriculture and I had a dream where rooftop buildings, apartment buildings, high rises in urban centers would have greenhouses on them so efficient that they could feed every member of the building below. And capitalism corrupted me for my career. And I think this project, the water project, brings me back to something that feels a little bit better in my bones, where I'm doing something that makes sense. That being said, being a foreigner, starting a water company can be seen as exploitative and has a pattern and history of exploitation. Large multinational corporations like Pepsi, Nestle, Coca-Cola control the water industry here. And so I am both adding to that problem and challenging it simultaneously. And I think holding that tension is difficult sometimes. And I'm trying to have dialogues with my community and my collaborators about where I fit into this. Should I leave after I kind of get it started? What feels right in this whole process? It feels like an important bridge for me to cross, because I can't just sit on my hands and not be an active community member, I don't think.
We've talked quite a bit about how you need to jump around from project to project or industry to industry. But probably the most challenging thing I might imagine about what you do is you dive into a fully formed, many times already existing team. Mm-hmm. To build trust, you're invited into a place of leadership. So it's not just trust with the peers and going kind of all the way down. And then you need to jettison out and move on. How do you think about building trust in that process? How do you think about influence? How do you think about connection in that world? Are there lessons around communication and leadership that you think you can pull out from that?
Absolutely. The word that's coming to mind right now for me is advocate. So if I can advocate on behalf of them and with them, then I can kind of do everything you just mentioned. I can build trust with them. I can demonstrate value. I can add to team cohesion, because a lot of times people are scared to talk to each other on teams because of dynamics that have arisen from the history of them working together. Organizational culture plays into things, like how open people feel, that what permission has been given by superiors to their team to voice their concerns and ideas. And so I think I'm liberating a lot of those unspoken things and doing it in a way that feels a little objective, because I'm an outside party, which plays to my advantage. Usually the way that I communicate is intentional. And so, like, when I'm listening to people and I'm asking questions and I'm staying curious about what they're going through and what their ideas are and how they feel like they can solve the problems that the organization is going through, they feel like a sense like that they can trust me to bring that forward. I hear, like, my favorite phrase when I'm first getting into an organization is, let me be honest, or let me be frank, or I'm going to be blunt. When I hear that, I know that I've gotten through a really important threshold with them. And my answer to that is always, please, of course, always, so that they really know that I'm here to try to listen and synthesize all this into, you know, a common vision. And then I just reflect back what I've heard from everybody. Mm. And when someone sees what they've said included in the vision, they feel heard and they know that I am advocating for them. And if they don't, I usually bring back some reason that feels substantial or significant so that they understand, you know, it's just not just radio silence of where their idea or concept went. And I've been really fortunate to bring a sense of cohesion to teams, especially around their product vision, in the last decade. And I'm excited to do more of that.
Do you ever see yourself needing to navigate the cultural dynamics on a team? And have you ever then needed to kind of make a shift in culture?
Yeah, there's a lot for us to talk about here. We could do a whole episode just on this, I think. But the most important one that I would like to talk about is the culture around iteration and learning. One culture that I witness a lot that I think impedes people is the culture of certainty. The culture of top down, you know, king or queen on high shouting down orders. And instead, to be curious and to listen to the customers, listen to the users, listen to the employees, everybody should be listening. And I think a lot of leaders are not listening enough or in the right ways to encourage genuine sharing. And if you can create an organizational culture where, you know, you're doing 360 reviews on like a quarterly basis, or you have some sort of feedback mechanism where people can make suggestions or put ideas, or if you're having meetings where there's like blue sky and people can really be creative, I see those organizations thriving a lot more. People are happier, more satisfied, and their products show that. You know, if you can try to remove your ego as a leader, you'll create an organizational culture of less ego in totality, and the organization will thrive because of that.
On one hand, that sounds really powerful and simple. On the other hand, if somebody has challenge with the ego, I think hearing that direction will probably be pretty difficult to absorb. So what has it looked like for you to change that in an organization?
I can't do it all by myself a lot. So I need to pull in some confidants of that person, whoever's ego is the biggest. So definitely get some allies involved. And then oftentimes I might suggest an executive coach or someone where they... putting them in a position where they can be reflective. And so I'm not telling them this. I'm not delivering the information that that their ego is the thing that's changing, you know, toxic for the entire organization. But it is, I'm trying to put them in an environment where they can come to that conclusion if they're open to it. And that's really the best I can do. If that doesn't work, I can try to be a little bit more blunt. But like you said, most folks who suffer from this don't really have their ears open to that kind of criticism.
Shifting gears a little bit, you know, we've covered quite a bit of ground here in terms of the toolkit that you bring to bear, the value and clarity of product vision, the role that like culture plays in getting through all of that. I'm curious if there are any other things you wish that either the people who worked with you or the people who might be potentially working with you in the future understood about what you do or the value that you bring that we've not got a chance to cover yet?
I guess it's the economics of this. I think of fractional leadership as really beneficial to both parties. Fractional leaders love what they do because they're working, like you were saying before, they're working on different projects. They're staying sharp. They're cross-pollinating strategies between industries, between phases of companies, between teams. And so they're at their best and they have flexible hours oftentimes. And so that's one of the benefits of fractional leadership for fractional leaders. Fractional leadership for startups or for the teams that we serve, we're offering a really low price for the years of experience and decades of experience that we often have across those industries. And currently, right? So if I'm working with a med tech company and a consumer tech company, they help each other. My experience helps both of those companies. And so I think when it comes down to economics, having really good product leadership, senior product leadership early on is really powerful, but most companies can't afford it. So fractional leadership solves that issue for software companies. And I can't advocate for it enough. So that's what I would share with the audience.
You kind of alluded a little bit to some of the other fun projects you have going on, but one of the challenges I know from people who are involved in fractional work is that it can be all consuming, right? It's not a 40 days a week kind of thing. There's a whole lot of things going on. You're always kind of in some ways in hunt mode for like the next contract. Mm-hmm. How do you think about balance, your personal life, the other things that are important to you, and integrating those right now? What are the other facets of your life that you find you need to balance?
I just had my first child. And so thank you. And so fractional work allowed me to take a couple of months off and be there with him, and still allows flexibility for me to be there in the mornings and evenings. So I've been able to achieve balance because of the type of work I do. I think I also feel really good emotionally about the work that I do because I know that the value for the dollars spent is benefits the startup more than the money I make. And so I go to sleep, you know, knowing that the $6,000, $8,000, $10,000 that they had spent with me that month has now propelled them into six figures of revenue or whatever, you know, the returns are so much more apparent. And so that makes the founders feel like the value is that much higher. And that makes me feel like I've chosen the right business model and kind of engagement model for myself.
That's fantastic. So if someone wanted to work with you as a fractional product leader, how should they go about getting in contact with you? How should they know whether they may be a potential great fit?
Sure. You can find me, you know, on my website, nickmcheveley.com, and I'm on LinkedIn there too. I work best with folks who are interested in learning about their customers more. So if they don't have a culture of user research or product discovery, customer discovery that has been working for them, or they feel like they've got a great idea, but they're not able to sell it or market it well, it's oftentimes because we're not listening to the customer. And so that'd be a great time to call me and we can see if it would be a good fit.
That brings us to the end of today's episode with Nick McEvely. We covered everything from navigating customer discovery and startup pivots to the ethical implications of AI and the importance of community in business. Nick's insights into fractional leadership and product development offer us invaluable lessons for anyone who's looking to drive impact in the startup world. A big thanks to Nick for sharing his expertise with us today. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with others in your network. And before you go, I'm excited to share that my new podcast, People and Possibilities, is now live. If you're curious about the future of work, leadership, and AI, make sure to check it out. Thank you, as always, for tuning in to Venture Visionaries. And until next time, keep building your vision and making an impact.